Hello, foreign entanglements and blogging heads viewers. I am Dr. Ron Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. With me today is David Axe, a freelance writer. He has a number of books to his credit on just a wide variety of different subjects. We actually I owe him a book review at some point, so sometime we're going to have a conversation, hopefully on this episode, on this program, about his book on logistics from A to B, which I'm about halfway through, and I am embarrassed that I have failed to finish it to this point.
Take your time. It's a slow read.
Right. So we were originally going to have this conversation about the more recent report about from Department of Defense about China's military structure as of 2012. This is an annual report, but it turns out that something more interesting has happened in the last couple days with regard to David. And I guess I'll just let you go into the story, and we may get to the China stuff at the end, but this is sort of a more interesting story right now, and it goes a lot of different directions. So why don't you start off and tell us what happened?
Okay, great. So last week I was at the Special Operations Forces Industry Conference in Tampa. SOFIC is a trade conference held every 4 or 5 years that brings together the U.S. and allied special operations communities plus the defense industry, the goal being to sort of explore technological problems and hardware and partnerships between different nations' commando units and mostly U.S. industry, but international industry as well. So reporters are invited to these things, and I've covered special forces for a number of publications. Back in January and February, I embedded with 10th Special Forces Group in Afghanistan, and wrote for Wired and a number of other publications. So I was at SOFIC last week and was just dropping in at different events, panel presentations, things of that nature, and sat in on a panel discussion by Theater Special Operations Command, Special Operations Forces commanders. So in other words, the top commando officers from the U.S. for different regions, the Pacific, Africa, Europe, etc. Mm-hmm. When the gentleman who runs U.S. Special Operations Forces in Korea got up to speak, when it was his turn to speak, his name is Brigadier General Neil Tolley. And he spoke for about 5 minutes, and I'm going to recap what he said. And I'm not directly quoting him unless I indicate with, finger quotes or something. Mm-hmm. But he started out by saying Korea is unique. North Korea obviously is the threat on the Korean Peninsula, and North Korea has thousands of tunnels and other buried military facilities. So he said that presents a unique problem because our satellites cannot look into them. Mm-hmm. So he said we have to put, and here I'm going to attempt to quote him, he said, humans. We have to put humans there. Humans was the word he used. Mm-hmm. And he spoke in the present tense. And he said the construction was have to put or place humans there. And then his next sentence included this phrase. He said, and here I'm going to attempt to directly quote him. He said, this is according to my own notebook, we send ROC, that's Republic of Korea, a.k.a. South Korea, ROC and U.S. soldiers into the north, I think that's exactly how he said it, into the north to conduct special reconnaissance. Forgive me if I got a couple of those nouns wrong, but it was, present tense, we send, and then ROC and U.S. soldiers into the north. And the exact term was special reconnaissance. So I'm listening to this and jotting down notes. And I didn't have any intention of actually using this immediately. I was doing some reporting for various publications, but I sort of had a program mapped out for what I was going to cover. I had just dropped in on other events just in case there was something interesting said. So I had lots and lots of notes, and Tolley's comments were just one of the accounted for two of the pages of the dozens of pages of notes that I took at the conference. I thought it was interesting, this admission that the U.S. is sending special forces into North Korea to spy on North Korean tunnels. Interesting to me, and it was news to me, but it didn't really shock me. I've covered Afghanistan, I've covered Africa, I've covered East Africa, and we have U.S. special forces presences in all of those regions, and most Americans don't know it. In many cases, it's entirely unreported, in any official capacity.
Now, when I saw your initial blog post on this, I had almost exactly the same reaction, which was, well, that's certainly interesting. I had never thought of that before, sort of just carved a place by it. This is not, world transformation. I mean, part of that is because I didn't really think through it, too, but I just sort of compartmentalized that in the back of my head as saying, oh, so U.S. and ROK recon forces in North Korea, right? And so I didn't think through all of the technical details of what that would reflect. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, it wasn't shocking to me. So I sort of put that aside. And wandering out of the auditorium, and you have to bear in mind, this is an auditorium full of hundreds of industry representatives and military types and government types and a handful of reporters. Just sort of a big, loud venue. Lots of people coming and going, different events all happening one after another. So I just, dropped in, took my notes, and headed out and went on to other interviews and other stories. A few days later, I had an ongoing assignment for a publication called The Diplomat, based in Tokyo, which covers the Asia-Pacific. And so I was digging through my notes for some little snippet to use in my weekly Diplomat blog post. My assignment, my job at The Diplomat, my sort of ongoing job, was to just once a week throw some scraps of reporting their way. I don't remember the exact terminology that my editor had used two or three years ago when I first got this gig, but it was just like, whatever leftovers you've got, just something interesting to add to the conversation, throw it out there and we'll put it up on the blog. And then on occasion I also do features for The Diplomat. So I've sort of had this 3-year relationship with them, and digging through my notes, and I came across this, and I was like, well, you know what? I've never written about this before. It seems interesting to me. I'm going to go ahead and write that up. And the lead was U.S. Special Forces are in North Korea spying on tunnels. And then I went on to talk about some of the technological problems that Brigadier General Tolley mentioned as being invested in this, this whole type of operation, the unique challenges and the unique equipment you could use to overcome those challenges. Mm-hmm. And, in my own mind, being largely a tech reporter, it was the tech that really interested me, but I used the to me, previously unknown fact that U.S. Special Forces were in North Korea as the lead. And then I filed it and forgot about it. And so did my editor, apparently, because he sat on it for a few days. And then finally on Monday published it, untouched, same headline, everything the same as I filed it. And I noticed that it was up, and I was like, oh, okay, good, great. And, I linked to it and tweeted it and then again forgot about it. then morning comes around, morning Asia time, which would be Monday Eastern, U.S. Eastern time, very, very late at night. It would be, roughly 8 o'clock in the morning in South Korea. And shit just hit the fan. Scores of publications used our tiny little blog post, which was, 3 or 4 paragraphs long, and a couple hundred words, 300 words at most, I guess, and used that as the foundation of a whole bunch of articles, more or less stating that we were invading North Korea. and that was shocking enough. But it was fine, whatever, as long as you don't misquote me, I'm cool. But then U.S. Forces Korea put out a statement saying this is not true, and the reporter quote, made up quotations that he attributed to Brigadier General Tolley.
Mm-hmm.
So the shitstorm got even worse, and I'm getting, it's now very late at night. I had just gotten home from celebrating Memorial Day, and I'm getting phone calls from bureaus in Seoul and Tokyo and people begging for interviews, and, you know, I granted every single one. I'm on Twitter. I'm on email.
You're on Blogging Heads now, so.
I'm blogging. It was very hard to deal with at 3 in the morning after an evening of partying, in part because my power went out. But also, it was the middle of the night, U.S. time. I couldn't get a hold of my U.S.-based editor for The Diplomat, and I certainly couldn't get a hold of the conference organizers or U.S. Special Operations Command in Florida for comments. So I just had to sort of roll with it as best I could in the middle of the night. Ended up, I'm still awake. I haven't slept in 2 days. Spent all night trying to manage this. The reporting from other outlets quickly transformed into American Reporter fakes news story about invasion of North Korea. And so the accusation was that I had invented this story, and that was the assertion that U.S. Forces Korea was making as well.
Did the interviews and so forth, I mean, did questions to you start reflecting that storyline, or were people, especially in Asia, still interested in the matter, the subject matter of the storyline?
There were differences between how Asia... The subject matter itself quickly dropped away. The story became the story immediately.
Okay.
And I was getting questions, and I have to say that everyone I spoke to, every reporter I spoke to was very courteous and professional, and it was fine. Mm-hmm. But the story did definitely become the story, and I was getting questions like, have you ever been wrong before? To which I would respond, well, yeah. I mean, I've been a reporter for 12 years. Yeah, I've been wrong. I've never fabricated a story, but have I been wrong? Sure. They're like, okay, well, give us specific examples of when you've been wrong. And my policy has always been that I'm pretty transparent about everything that I do. I write for a lot of different outlets, and I also write comics, memoirs, and blog. And so, you know, if you pay close enough attention, you can see not only the subjects I'm reporting on, but how I report on them. Again, transparent, and I'm willing to be perfectly transparent about this story as well. So I told everyone exactly what had happened, which is that I went to this conference, I sat in this big audience, I listened to Brigadier General Tolley talk, I wrote down exactly what I heard him say, I walked out, and I decided a couple days later that it was worth publishing. And I sent it in, and it appeared verbatim on the website. So in other words, no, I did not fabricate this. The comment from U.S. Forces Korea, their official statement, said that Brigadier General Tolley was only speaking hypothetically when he described special reconnaissance in North Korea. And that may very well be the case, but he did not say that.
Right.
That I never wavered from that point. I kept saying, okay, maybe he was being hypothetical, but how was I supposed to know? He never said it. People began to call into question my note taking. So I photographed my notes and I put them online.
We're gonna have links to most of this. It'll be off the Blogging Heads site. It'll be on a tab, and so we'll have a lot of links to the posts, especially the context post that you have that has the notes on the images.
So, yeah, I mean, I kept a running... I knew this thing was going to blow up, or I could tell about an hour into it that it was going to be huge, so I kept a sort of running update on my blog, warisboring.com, with statements from various people and links to things, and the photo of my notes, so you can see exactly what I wrote down. I mean, of course, I can't prove that I actually wrote those notes at the time, right? But, I mean, there they are. Take them or leave them.
We've all seen Shattered Glass, so we know that. Yeah, we definitely know that part. So.
Right. And I sent emails to various people trying to get transcripts of the event, and it was told initially that transcripts would eventually be forthcoming. That later turned out not to be true. By about 7 in the morning, so I'd been at this for about 8 hours, it kind of reached a low point. The diplomat was not happy, understandably, and so I volunteered to step down from in my role as contributor. But I asked that in our note, you know, in our quote-unquote correction, that we stress that if the general were speaking hypothetically, he did not say so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So, I stepped down, 7 in the morning, I went to bed for like 2 hours, woke back up, and was right at it again. By that point, I was really angry. I did get a hold of U.S. Forces Korea. Brigadier General Tolley was out for the day, and even though it was early afternoon by the time their time when I called, and I did get a hold of his spokesman, a Colonel Withington, who said that he said, and I'm paraphrasing, he only knew what he'd been told because he didn't have a transcript of the event,
right.
Which became a sort of running problem, this constant problem, no transcript. And I kept making, you know, I made requests for a transcript, but it ultimately was told there would be no transcript. I'm not sure why, because I know there were, I'm fairly certain, actually I know for a fact, there were cameras in the room belonging to the event, because the speakers were broadcast onto screens around the room. But as far as I knew, there were only print reporters in the room. There had been other publications that mentioned Tolley's comments, although in slightly different contexts, prior to my own post. But being, some of them were very wonky industry stuff that I guess sort of slipped below the radar,
right.
And didn't put the special reconnaissance in the lead. So by late morning, this morning, Tuesday, you know, it was pretty bleak, and I was getting upset because I was starting to feel like I was going crazy. I mean, I was there. I took notes. I've been doing this for 12 years. I know how to take notes. And I was looking at my notes like they were lying to me. But I wrote those notes. And I remember the conversations I had with other people as I walked out of the auditorium. Everybody's like, well, that was interesting. I'd never heard that before. So, you know, it's like my memory, I felt like my memory was betraying me. So I kind of went on the offensive. I reached out to reporters that I knew were in the room, or that I thought were in the room, to find out were they indeed in the room, and could they get involved to try to corroborate my own reporting. Sure enough, two reporters that I'm on good terms with, Kim Dozier from AP and Sean Naylor from Army Times, although he was there independently. He wasn't there for Army Times. He was there on his own. Anyways, they were both in the room and both sent notes saying, yes, David was telling the truth. That is what Brigadier General Tolley said. So, you know, I'm getting all this out on the blog and on Twitter. U.S. Forces Korea is in bed by this point, so there's no talking to them. I never did get a note back from the organization NDIA, National Defense Industrial Association, that organized the event. But in the afternoon, the Pentagon, George Little, the spokesman, the DOD spokesman, held a press conference, a televised press conference, where they stated in no uncertain terms, there are no U.S. special forces in North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Did they say ROK as well, or did they just say no U.S. special forces?
I only caught bits of it, because I don't actually have a TV, so I had to catch streaming little bits of it streaming online. So I didn't see the whole thing. But I did talk to folks about it, and I talked to folks who were there.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a transcript of that, of Little's comments online, if you dig around for it. So I was just hopping mad by this point. I mean, I had been very diligent about showing my notes and talking about the process, reaching out to corroborating sources, of which I had two at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been just one statement from Brigadier General Tolley, without his name on it, through a spokesman who admitted he knew nothing about what was going on,
right.
Claiming that I made up the story. And it had resulted in me feeling like, and I stepped down from the diplomat, I wasn't fired. I mean, I might have been if I'd stuck around, but that was the right thing to do to try to protect the publication. And I'm not happy that I felt that was necessary to do. I would rather not have stepped down from, you know, a long-term paying gig. I'm proud of the diplomat. It's a fine publication. I'd like to continue working there.
Right. No, I recommend it as well. It has a lot of interesting people. It has some people from the Naval War College. You know, James Holmes contributes there. And so yeah, no, it's an excellent.
Absolutely, it's great. So I, you know, by now I had pretty good corroborating evidence that I did not misreport this.
Mm-hmm.
the real decisive moment was when Kim Dozier from AP, after, I think this happened after the Pentagon press conference, walked up to the public affairs officers and played them a recording of the conversation. She had been emailing me, and so she said, she eventually told me about this whole coup that she pulled off. She played a recording of the conversation, and it was, it was what I had reported. It was the same quotations that I had reported. I finally got a hold of Lieutenant Colonel Jim Gregory, who's a Pentagon spokesman, I've published his comments on my blog, War is Boring. This was sort of the end of the whole affair so far. Mm-hmm. He said, "You're right, David. You did not misquote Brigadier General Tolley." He said he was not going, and I'm not quoting him here, but paraphrasing, mm-hmm. he said he was not going to defend U.S. Forces Korea's statement. Mm-hmm. He said he expected U.S. Forces Korea to take a fresh look at their statement when they woke up, which would be now-ish. Right. They've been up for a couple hours by now. And that he said, just we're on your side. Try to get through this, and we certainly don't want you to be fired.
Right. So, no, he also didn't. If I recollect correctly, he also prefaced that by saying, "But there are no boots on the ground in North Korea." Right. I mean, or
yes.
To my recollection. But we'll get to that in a second. But anyway. But he said both.
Yeah. There is some interesting stuff there. But yeah. So he said there are no boots in U.S. boots in North Korea, but. You did not misreport the story. General Tolley did indeed say the things you said he said. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of the criticism at that point was that I should have gotten another interview with General Tolley.
Right.
Kim Dozier did. She tracked him down at the conference and got additional comments from him mm-hmm. where he stressed in private to her that he was speaking hypothetically. But he never said that during his public comments.
Right.
He just said, "We send U.S. and ROK soldiers into North Korea." So so I didn't know about his assertion at the conference that this was hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
I only had what he said in a public setting. I got my little... it's not exactly a retraction from the Pentagon, but they have finally admitted that the claim that I created the story, that I made stuff up, is not true. So I'm waiting for a second round of interviews from Asian media. They're all sort of working up right now, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'm waiting for a revised statement from U.S. Forces Korea. I have asked for a retraction of their statement, a full retraction of their statement.
Of the made-up.
That I made up the...
Yeah.
Special Forces in Korea story. So that's where we stand right now.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, this is, I'm sitting here and I'm listening. And I was familiar with most of it. I mean, I hadn't really tracked your entire stuff going on during the day. But, it's because when I'm thinking about here, well, why didn't you go for a follow-up interview, something like that? Because you're exactly right in terms of saying that, this was just sort of a, because I've had similar sorts of jobs before, like with the American Prospect and so forth, where essentially I had the responsibility for reporting like just a stub or something along those lines, right? And something
yeah.
you would never, take all that seriously in terms of trying to, needing to get confirmatory interviews for somebody's public statement or something along those lines, right?
Well, right, but I'm totally happy for people to sit down with me and say, "We disagree with your mm-hmm. judgment call regarding a follow-up interview."
Right.
If you want to make this, if you want to make the issue that I should have done more reporting, that's fine. Let's talk about that. I might even just say, "You're right. I should have done more reporting." But do not tell me that I lied. I did not lie. I reported what was told to me and hundreds of people verbatim.
Well,
that's the issue that I have, is that I'm being accused of inventing things. I did not do that.
I mean, a United States general is a public official, right? When a public official says something in public, it's public information, right? And it's newsworthy automatically, whether you get a second interview or not, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's obvious that it is a subject which could bear more reporting, right? And I think is certainly going to over the next week or so. But it's still very interesting how the interaction between sort of old style journalistic norms with the demands of sort of constant consumption of new media. So, well, I mean, let's if we could. So, I mean, right now we're in a situation where the official U.S. government position is mostly that these words were said and that they refer to a hypothetical case.
Right.
But of course, you know, the U.S. government would never actually say that it was actually deploying special reconnaissance forces in North Korea. And we also, whenever you're talking about a hypothetical case, right, the hypothetical case has to have certain triggering events, right? And we don't have a notion of what those triggering events, right, might be, right? So, okay, well, so you're developing a set of plans to deploy, and you're even thinking about how to equip. I mean, that was the whole point of this technological conference, is you're thinking seriously about how to equip these special reconnaissance forces in North Korea, right? And so, you know, we have moved forward to the point where, you know, we either maybe have and are not telling people, which would be entirely understandable given the nature of SOF, or we're maybe thinking very seriously about doing this, and we're going so far as to equip our people in order to have the capabilities for doing this. So there's some planning happening either way.
Right, and Jeffrey Lewis, known online as the, what is it, Arms Control Wonk or something?
Yeah, Arms Control Wonk, yeah.
Yeah, Jeffrey Lewis has researched this, and actually it turns out we have deployed special forces and, you know, I'm not sure where that overlaps with CIA operatives, but we have deployed intelligence assets up to and including special forces in North Korea in the past, since the Korean War.
Right.
So, you know, it has happened. Right. It's never been exhaustively and fully publicly disclosed by the government, but it's verifiable. So right. he was tweeting about that all day as sort of a parallel story to my own unfolding drama.
Right. No, and he does a ton of stuff on the North Korean nuclear program and sort of where the North Korean nuclear program is going. So can we talk just a little bit about? I mean, exactly would these people be doing in North Korea, right? What sort of information would they be trying to acquire, even in a hypothetical scenario? What kind of information would you be trying to acquire?
I'll echo what General Tolley said. They're looking into tunnels. He said that the problem is satellites can't look into tunnels, so you need to send in people. But the problem there is that the people need to, he used the word leap. He said people need equipment that's lightweight because you can't, quote, leap a truck into North Korea, so you can't have a truck hauling a 5-ton sensor.
Right, right.
So I'm assuming what he means there is high altitude, low opening halo parachute insertions, which coincidentally was demonstrated at the SOFIC conference by live operators who jumped into the river behind the convention center. So I'm assuming he was talking about halo. I don't know for a fact he's talking about halo, but he did say leap. And so, you would jump in, Special Forces operators. Special Operations Command does talk about special reconnaissance as being a core mission. And they just have to spy on these tunnels, try to get some angle visually or with some other type of sensor, say, I'm speculating here, a chemical sensor, to understand what's inside the tunnel. Tolley talked about that. He said we need sensors that are lightweight enough to give us, an ability to analyze these tunnels, and also lightweight enough to be carried in by men. He also said that he needs better communications because up that high, latitude-wise, SATCOMs don't work because satellites tend to be equatorial, so you can't get a line of sight to the satellite, so they use high-frequency radio instead. But high-frequency radio can be traced back to its origin. So HF communications is problematic for Special Forces teams because you can track them. So he said he wants a less trackable HF radio. He also said that he doesn't want special operators jumping with or going into places like North Korea with heavy loads of support equipment, including batteries. Mm-hmm. So he would like to see wireless power transmission, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that does make sense, yeah.
So he's talking about these sort of conjectural equipment needs that would enable him, his forces, to do the special reconnaissance mission better. And, you know, industry is supposed to take that and run with it.
Right. No, and so it was a sort of a wish list to industry to produce this sort of equipment. The jumping makes sense. What the extraction would presumably be also be by helicopter, right? Or could it presumably be by boat
that
you would
me.
Get these people out? I mean, I think everybody's probably thinking about stealth helicopters and the Osama bin Laden raid,
right.
About whether you could do that over North Korean air defenses.
You probably could, I guess. I mean, North Korea is, I understand, a very difficult air defense nut to crack. And I'm not a North Korea expert by any means.
Right.
I'm not really an expert on much of anything. But at SOFIC, at the conference, SOCOM did demonstrate a whole bunch of sort of whiz-bang, cool insertion and extraction techniques there on the river behind the convention center just for fun, right, to show the audience something cool. So they had MV-22 tilt rotors, Osprey tilt rotors flying over. They had Chinook Special Forces helicopters, Black Hawk Special Forces helicopters. They had guys who did halo jumps from high altitude from the C-130 into the river. They had Special Forces boats. And these things both inserted and extracted actual live U.S. and allied special operators there at the convention center for a little mock battle. From my own reporting, I know that SOCOM relies heavily on nuclear-powered submarines to deploy forces into coastal zones. So, SOCOM has a number of ways to infiltrate and exfiltrate people. Which of those are best or even feasible in a dangerous air defense environment or in the kind of mountainous terrain that you often see in North Korea?
It would have to depend on where you wanted to go in North Korea, right? I mean, obviously you can't expect a special forces team to go 100 miles overland and then 100 miles back to an extraction zone from a submarine, or maybe not.
Right. But we do know that many of these tunnels that Tolley was talking about are near the demilitarized zone. He did mention thousands of underground artillery emplacements. And, you know, it's been sort of a bugaboo of potential conflict in Korea that so many of these artillery pieces are within range of Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not far from the DMZ. I don't know how that would alter the equation in terms of infiltrating and exfilling special forces, but it's not the same as dropping somebody into downtown, Pyongyang. So.
Right, exactly. I mean, and so, in some sense, the hope is that you'll be able to produce the sort of intelligence about North Korea's various, I mean, presumably most importantly, the nuclear program, but also the ballistic missile program, also potentially chemical and biological programs, even potentially conventional programs, even their conventional deployments and so forth. That's sort of as cool as what the Israelis did with the Syrian box, sort of the pictures and so forth that they presented of what was going on in Syria. And that's another thing that sort of leapt to my mind when I was thinking about this story. Although that was different, right? Because that was not very special forces. That was more sort of straightforward intelligence work, if I'm recollecting correctly. I don't remember exactly how they got the pictures from inside the box.
I don't actually know. I mean, a lot of what special forces do is intelligence gathering, though.
Right.
They're always eager to stress that they're not just lethal raiders who drop in the dead of night and kill people. They, in fact, have often gone out of their way to stress that that's a rare mission. And different elements of SOCOM do different things, but Army Special Forces, for instance, mostly have an advisory role, training up allied militaries. Navy SEALs tend to have a more kinetic, killing, raiding role, but even they do a great deal of reconnaissance. In as much as North Korea represents an intelligence problem, and it's a massive intelligence problem, special forces, if they're not being currently used in an intelligence gathering role on the Korean Peninsula, they certainly have the potential to be given a certain degree of escalation of the Cold War there.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the status? Do you know anything about the status? Because another interesting aspect of this to me is the role of the Republic of South Korea, Republic of Korea. what is the status of their special forces? You know, because to a layman, it would almost seem so sensible to drop South Korean special forces into North Korea to undertake careful intelligence and reconnaissance work, given that, you know, they, you know, a whole bunch of reasons why it makes more sense for South Koreans than North Koreans.
Right.
Do you know much about South Korea's special forces capability? Or, I mean, what part, how has that story come out? Or how has this been responded to in South Korea?
It surprisingly has been mentioned very little in in South Korea proper. It's being mentioned by a lot of foreign bureaus in South Korea, and by surrounding countries, media in surrounding countries. So I'm not really sure how the South Korean media is taking the story or the story of the story. And I don't know much about ROK, Republic of Korea Special Forces, except to say that Tolley, in his comments that he's now trying to distance himself from, or I'm sorry, that the army is trying to distance itself from, that Tolley said, we send Republic of Korea and U.S. soldiers. So presumably they work side by side. And we did see a lot of that sort of international cooperation even at the SOFIC conference. One of the themes of the conference was building the global special operations forces partnership. And there were, you know, special operators from, what was the number? It was like 90 countries or something at the conference. So it was pretty nutty. I mean, it was a big, happy special operations family. I would not be surprised at all to discover that U.S. and South Korean special operators work very, very closely together.
Right. I mean, I'd be pretty surprised to find that they didn't.
Right.
That's a pretty interesting. You know that my work is on military institutions, and I know we've talked a lot about sort of, and there are a lot of arguments out there and discussions about how, say, an independent Air Force affects, you know, whether for ill or for good, affects the way that the U.S. government makes decisions, right? How having institutions in a particular way transforms the options that are presented to policymakers. Because when I first read about this too, the idea occurred to me that this is at least in part about the greater institutional voice that the SOF community is having, you know, especially since last year with Osama bin Laden, especially since 2001, but really sort of a growing during even, you know, during the bad years in the 1980s, but growing in the 90s and so forth. I mean, is this something where, you know, the SOF community is really sort of making its voice heard in areas where they had not previously been heard, right? Even in sort of very conventional warfighting environments like North Korea. And sort of, would we expect the SOF community to have an even greater voice in these kinds of issues going forward, right? Almost a quasi-service, sort of. Do you have any thoughts along those lines?
Yes, absolutely, but I would put a slightly different twist on it. At the SOFIC conference, we had a surprise guest, well, surprise to me at least, Hillary Clinton. Showed up.
That's right. That's right. That was that the Shadow Warriors? Did she say diplomats are Shadow Warriors? Was that at that conference?
Did she say what about Shadow Warriors?
She recently made some comment about diplomats being Shadow Warriors, State Department.
I think you're just quoting somebody's headline. I don't know if she used the term Shadow Warriors, but she was there to talk about the partnership between SOCOM, Special Operations Forces in general, because I think that would include Allied Nations Special Operations Forces. To talk about the partnership between SOF and the State Department. She said that these two entities are natural partners because they are accustomed to doing culturally sensitive, low-intensity conflict prevention and intervention sort of in austere environments, in a place where, you know, you... you don't want to deploy an army division. So she was there to embrace Special Operations Forces less as a military force and more as a diplomatic force. I sort of saw her appearance there as the State Department and Special Operations Command walking towards each other and meeting in that middle zone between diplomacy and war. It was very interesting.
Right. No, it is really interesting. I mean, you can sort of you can see the incentives in either direction, right? I mean, you can see the SOF community having an interest in building sort of bureaucratic and institutional support across government, right? Not just, I mean, there's a lot of, not all of our viewers may be familiar with this, but there's a lot of good literature about the historically troubled relationship between the SOS community and the rest of the uniformed services, and it has been historically troubled. And you can also see the point from State Department, which is sort of, there's a constant refrain, almost also from the DoD side at this point, there's a constant refrain about the lack of resources that State has. And so you can also see, you know, why these two bureaucracies, these two institutional groups would be interested in coming together and interested in having a relationship with one another. That's fascinating. Right. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. That's really interesting. And I didn't realize that Clinton had been at that event, but that certainly tells a lot about how the State Department is thinking about this. So,
yeah, you know, as the era of big army ground wars, albeit low intensity ground wars, but still mm-hmm. resource intensive low intensity ground wars, mm-hmm. as that winds down, I mean, it's sort of conventional wisdom that you'll see the role of special forces increasing.
Right.
And the danger there is, of course, as you sort of implied with your comments about the Air Force, if you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Right.
So if you have an incredibly large and powerful special operations force, and make no mistake, the United States does, SOCOM has, is it 75, 80,000 people?
Yeah,
which
not
is,
sure exactly.
You know, as big as the British Army. So when you have a special operations force that large and... never mind its size, but that capable, of course there's going to be a temptation to use it even if it's not the best solution to the problem.
Right, right. And the coolness factor you just mentioned is a part of this, right? I mean, the Air Force doesn't give air shows just for fun, right? They give air shows because it demonstrates how awesome the Air Force is. And the stuff you were talking about with the Halo jumps and the MV-22s and so forth, all of that is really cool, right? And it's
yes.
really cool, especially for civilians, who don't necessarily, you know, have a ton of experience or a ton of interest in military affairs, right? And so you can see how the voices of SOF would carry disproportionate weight in a civilian bureaucracy where national security decisions are being made.
I think the secrecy plays into that.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Special forces don't just adopt an aura of secrecy for operational purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's useful. A measure of operational security ensures, you know, surprise and allows you to navigate local cultural obstacles. So that's all great. But there's an added benefit of secrecy, which is mystique. And the mystery lends power to special operations forces. If you don't know what they do, if you don't understand them, if you can't see their faces, if you don't get their names, they're scarier.
Right.
You know, if you find out it's just a John Smith with two kids who lives in Tallahassee, it's just not nearly as scary. So, yeah, you know, he's maybe a bit tougher and smarter than your average soldier, but he's still just a soldier.
Right. So, sort of as a final comment here, and I don't want to frame this in terms of lessons learned or anything like this, but I mean, are you going to do anything differently at shows like this in the future? I mean, when you get a comment like this, when you get something, I know, and in this case, it's weird, right? Because you didn't even think that this was particularly significant, right? And so it, you know, it wasn't even something that sort of called for a tremendous, a greater amount of due diligence. But I mean, is this experience going to change how you behave or how you act, or is there any way, or no, or is there just no way to do that?
I have learned some very specific lessons in regards to writing about Korea. That place is tense. So, honestly, I did not expect...
uh-huh.
I mean,
right.
Call me silly or naive, but I did not appreciate that that even the implication of U.S. forces in North Korea would become a huge and fast-moving international crisis. Again... it's my fault. Call me naive and silly. So now I know that, and in future reporting on the Koreas, I'm going to be much more mindful of the explosive nature of the thing. I mean, I feel like you could throw all sorts of shit at Pakistan, Mm-hmm, and nobody's right. going to freak out about it. But you throw shit at the Koreas, people get upset. Yes, that's an important lesson there. You can always do more due diligence. Where do you draw the line? Let's just say when it comes to dealing with interesting comments from special operators, I'm going to add a layer of due diligence. And here's why. It's not just that I'm stung by this experience with a diplomat story. It's that I suspect... No, actually, I know for a fact that many special operators have very little media experience because of their aura of secrecy. And I know this as well from embedding with a special forces unit in Afghanistan back in the winter.
That's really interesting.
It was rocky. It was real rocky. They didn't quite know what a reporter was or what a reporter did, for all of their obvious intelligence. So you have to approach, I think you have to approach special forces sources almost as though they are more innocent than regular forces sources. Mm-hmm. Like, does this commando general really understand that he's talking to a public audience? Because he may not.
Right.
Does he know what it means to make on-the-record comments? Because he may not.
Right. I mean, I had never thought about sort of the aura of secrecy sort of folding back in that particular direction.
It definitely does. It definitely
in
does.
Terms of a lot of special training.
A lot of special forces units don't have public affairs officers, mm-hmm. whereas you know every regular battalion has a little public affairs unit, a little mm-hmm. cell embedded in it. So. But no, special operators often don't. They don't have the rules and systems and training for handling media.
Okay. All right. Well,
it turns out you can't just say whatever you want to a room that includes reporters.
Right. All right. Well, I mean, I think you have something else going on in about 5 minutes, so
yeah.
I think we'll close it right here.
Great.
But thanks very much for telling the story. I mean, I think it's fascinating not just for the Korea and for the subject matter, but also for the journalism story.
Great.
And so, you know, hopefully, and I'll keep following it, obviously, and I, you know, hopefully the Blogging Heads viewers will keep following it too. So
hopefully, I'm still employed tomorrow.
Well, I'm sure you'll still be employed somewhere. So, you know, there's that.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
All right, thanks a lot, David.
Bye.